This is Melissa. Happy Easter. It is the 20th day of April, 2025. I hope you're all doing well. So for those of you listening, Easter will have different meanings depending on who you are and where you are. And I've decorated an Easter egg or two in my day and gone to holy services during this, what is in the Christian tradition, the holiest of weeks. I was struggling a bit, as I often do, choosing which of Alan's talks I wanted to replay for you today. And last year, I picked one that I thought was such a good talk of Alan's. I really nailed it on the head. I don't have it in front of me. I just know that the redux that I put up was redux number 154, and I retitled it Happy Easter from the Matrix to the True Trinity. And I'll try to find you the original audio on that, but the whole thing was really good. And I just thought it was perfect, and I wanted to try to be to get perfect again this year, but alas, I couldn't. I was talking to Graham and Gabriella, who live in Germany. Graham is Scottish. Just yesterday, we were having a nice long conversation, catching up on a lot of things, and I mentioned to them that I had listened to a couple of different talks, and I was telling him the latest one that I'd listened to, and it was good, but I said, I just don't think that's right for Easter. And he said, well, I'll give you a suggestion, one that I just listened to, take it or leave it. And I have decided to go with that. So this is August the 2nd, 2005. And Alan was filling in for Jackie Petru on her show, Sweet Liberty. This is after the series of talks that they had between 1998 and the year 2000, which became the Waiting for the Miracle series of talks. So she's got some kind of, he called it, I think, battle fatigue. And so he stood in for her. And I'm going to trim just a couple of things out. He does a request that you send her money to support her. And she's no longer on the go in any form. And so I thought I would just cut that out. I am going to leave a little bit in where he describes the books, because one of the talks that I was listening to in considering putting it up for today was the Slimy Nematode talk from 2007. And Alan was just really letting go with a lambasting for people who were ripping him off, you know, pirating his books, uploading them. And he said, this is how I support myself. And I could go a lot further. I could go a lot further in my talks, you know, esoterically than anyone out there. But I also have to keep a roof over my head. So I had been listening to that one because, well, I was considering it for today, but also because I regularly get this angry criticism from people. And I'll tell you what it is. They say, oh, it's just terrible that, you know, Alan put up all of his stuff for free and now you're charging money for it, which is, you know, it's ridiculous because it's not true. But I'll spell it out for them. I say, in the last part of Alan's life, when the audio CDs had accumulated, by the last year of his life, there were 65 of them that you could order that included all of his audio talks, and they were $40 a piece. And if you bought them all at $40 a piece, that was $2,600. And one of the first things that I did when he passed away was I cut the price of those in half. So if you wanted to collect all of his audios, they were $1,300. And, you know, so the criticism people are angry about the flash drives, which I'm just going to say is they're beautiful, and I'm so proud of myself and thankful for those who helped me put this together that I can offer this to you because they're beautiful. It takes all of those audios of Alan's and his videos, in other words, a couple of things that were always for sale, never for free download. And if you buy them all at one time, that's $550. And even at $700, if you spread the purchase across, I mean, think about that. $700 compared to $2,600. But when I spell this out for people, they never bother to get back and say, oh, and I remind them, and hey, the audios are still on the website for free download, as they always have been, and if I have anything to do with it, they always will be. But they never write back and say, oh, sorry, I didn't know, I didn't, you know, it's just the criticism. So that's my own slimy nematode talk, where, you know, people just want to criticize and hate on you because of whatever, because that's where they are. So I heard the suggestion from Graham and I listened to it and I thought, yeah, that's a good one. I like that. I can see why he went with that. And he actually touched on a few things, you know, as Alan succinctly tells us what the problem is, how old the problem is, and how profound it is. He gives us the antidote, and the antidote is to be an individual. How simple is that? A few weeks ago, maybe just a couple of weeks ago, in the New York Times, and I'll have to say, they call papers, newspapers that are supposedly important, like The Guardian or the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times, they call them papers or newspapers of record, to, you know, because it's where you get the news that you can trust. It's a newspaper of record by reputation, or sometimes a journal of record. And Gerald Celente, who's made the Patriot rounds, and he's a trend forecaster and a financial guy, I guess. And I think, as far as I know, he's still on the go, but Gerald Celente humorously called the New York Times the toilet paper of record. But I like to check into that as kind of my go-to propaganda paper to see how one of, you know, the most prestigious newspapers in the world is putting across the propaganda. And sometimes they really even make me angry if I let myself get angry. They you know, because it's just such bald-faced lying and leaving out important details and, you know, not covering important stories, but covering trivia, and it just drives you crazy. And one that I got a couple of weeks ago was telling me, it was in the fluffy part of the newspaper, I can't remember what section that would be in. Let's see if I can find it. Oh, yes, here it is. How to Manage Dust was the title of the article. And I'm going to see, okay, so this is from a section of their newspaper called Wire Cutter. So it's home and garden, kitchen, health and lifestyle, tech, baby and kid, baby and little goat, I guess, style, gifts, skincare, deals, you know. So it's not hard news, it's not politics, etc. But it's How to Manage Dust from March 13, 2025. What is dust even made of, and how to manage it? So Carolyn Mullen is a writer, and she's focused on cleaning and organizing. Isn't that great that the New York Times brings us somebody who's focused on cleaning and organizing? She writes, if you ask me, the most annoying cleaning task is dusting. No matter how frequently I wipe down surfaces and vacuum nooks and crannies, dust just keeps coming back. It never seems to end. And I can't be the only one who feels like I'm always at war with dust buildup. That's because dust particles are always accumulating, no matter how diligent you are about cleaning them up. But it's not a total losing battle. Even though banishing dust entirely is impossible, knowing what's in dust can help you mitigate its accumulation. So she goes on to explain to us, what is dust and why does it matter? Household dust is a rather horrifying cocktail of organic and inorganic particles that most people would rather not think about. That cocktail commonly includes dead skin cells from humans and pets, or dander, hair and fur, dust mites, insect droppings and dead insect particles, soil, pollen, and other organic outdoor particles, microplastics, bacteria, mold, and fabric fibers. Dust can also include compounds from smoke and soot particles generated by burning candles, smoking, or cooking. This delightful combination of particles lingers in the air and collects on the surfaces and in the crevices of your home. Okay, I'd had enough there at that point, because what was going on a month ago, as it turns out, that is like 5 weeks now, isn't it? Time flies, was that we were having incredible dust storms in the U.S. And I had actually heard from some people that I spoke with in different parts of the world that they had noticed dustier than usual atmosphere. But in the U.S., particularly in the Midwest, in unbelievable dust storms. And so some days, there were a couple of days when it was like red sand and the sky turned red, you know, kind of biblical. And the dust, if you didn't have your house sealed up, but even if you did, was blowing in. And I got pictures from someone who lives in Ohio. I hope I got the state right, but I think it's Ohio. And she sent me a picture of her car, which was parked outside, and just the thickest layer of dust, but not dust, you know, just something that didn't really look natural. And I kind of gave up after a while, because it wasn't just the 2 days around the sandstorm, but it seemed that every day for a month, there was a film all over everything in my house. And after a couple of dustings in a week, I'm just like, okay, I give up, at least for the time being. I'll hit it again some other time. See, I could see the spraying. I could look up into the sky and see how heavily sprayed we are. And so we had a real storm last night in the wee hours of the morning, and we're probably due another one later on today, and the spraying is just intense. So I have seen from time to time musings in papers of record or magazines of record, such as Scientific American, just questioning whether we're due for another dust bowl like they had during the Depression era, when supposedly bad farming practices led to a drought and a dust, you know, bad farming practices combined with a drought led to this massive dust bowl that displaced many, many, many thousands of people. And you know, you can hear read a fictional account of that and Grapes of Wrath, the displacing of peoples, the uprooting of people from, say, Oklahoma, which was one of the state's worst hit, as they relocated to California. So when we listen to Alan talk in this particular talk that he delivers back in 2005, we listen carefully and we understand that these techniques are really ancient, many, many thousands of years old, and that even the techniques that we might think are cutting edge, that we have a device that we use to call someone or a device that we use to watch something. And he's telling you about, for instance, Nick Begich's demonstration of all of these different small handheld devices that could do a variety of things, interacting with HARP and other, you know, because HARP went supposedly silent for a while. HARP is high frequency active auroral research, and the primary one was in Alaska, and it supposedly went down for a while. They weren't actively using it. It said that they completed their work back in 2007, and then it was going to be permanently shut down in 2014, and then it was transferred over to the University of Alaska in 2015. And of course, if you look up HARP, it says here it's a target of conspiracy theorists who claim that it is capable of weather manipulation and mind control. Scientists and other critics point out that these claims fall well outside the abilities of the facility and often outside the scope of current natural science, because they tell us everything, don't they? They just keep us up to the minute. And if it's happening, you can find it in any reputable science journal. And if they're not telling you about it, then it's not real. It's just a conspiracy theory. So that was it. I kind of just had that annoyance that you can look up and you can see what's going on with your own eyes, but they must be lying eyes. So in this talk, Alan is pretty blunt about religion as a form of control. He just lays it out there. And once again, I was reminded of something that I had seen, and this one I think actually was new, probably yesterday or the day before. And also from that toilet paper of record, the New York Times. And it was talking about Christianity and the White House. Christianity in the White House. And that was from the 18th of April, 2025. The writer is Ruth Graham. She covers religion, faith, and values. And I guess that that's more important than cleaning an organization. She writes, "Today is Good Friday, part of the holiest week in the Christian calendar. President Trump is using this week to make a dramatic gesture to the conservative Christians who heard his campaign promise last year to, quote, bring back Christianity." And I'll post this. You can look at it if you want to, but it's the Christians around Trump and also a new department that he started in February of this year. So within 2 weeks of his inauguration ceremony, he had started a department in the White House, which I now can't find. It's the Faith Office, I guess. It may have a more official name than that, but it's the Faith Office, the White House Faith Office. And the article tells us that President George W. Bush established the first White House Faith Office in the early 2000s, and versions of it were carried out under later administrations. Some of them were working to direct some federal money to various faith-based groups providing social services. But in this term, Trump has given the office a higher stature and a broader mandate. The new faith office is led by Trump's longtime personal pastor, Paula White-Kane. So Paula White-Kane. And by Jennifer Korn, K-O-R-N, who worked in his first administration. Now, some of you longtime listeners to Alan will remember him talking. I'll just put you on this trail if you want to find it for yourselves or do some research for yourselves on the symbolic significance of the cornfield, and he would mention that the horror writer Stephen King pretty much always had a cornfield somewhere in one of his stories. And of course, Alan has talked about the significance of the name Cain and the Cain and Abel story from the Bible, and who was Cain, and the comparison of Cain to Nimrod. So we're talking builders, artificers, and even that original, you know, who is Nimrod, that the whole Luciferian connection there to the artificer, the first liar. But anyway, Paula came by her names quite legitimately. Her name was Paula Michelle Furr. She was born in Tupelo, Mississippi, into poverty and bad circumstances. And she married. Now, it's funny because she's keeping both her second married name and her third married name. But it's a pity that she didn't keep her first married name, which was Knight. Knight. So she married a man named Dean Knight, K-N-I-G-H-T. And they were divorced after 5 years of marriage. And then she married Randy White. And in 2015, she married Jonathan Cain. And Jonathan Cain, because I had to just dig this up and find out, he is known professionally. His surname that he was born with was Jonathan Leonard Frege. But he is known professionally as Jonathan Cain. He's an American musician, singer, and songwriter, best known as the keyboardist and rhythm guitarist for the band Journey. So he's inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as a member of Journey in 2017, and he also maintains a solo career as a contemporary Christian artist. So, What were the big songs of Journey? Faithfully, I'm trying to think. Were they the ones who did "Don't Stop Believin'"? That was one of their songs. Okay, good. I'm not completely dead yet, so I remember some things from my youth. So that was the band Journey, and that is her third husband. So Paula White Cain, or as I'll like to call her from now on, Paula Knight White Cain, is an American televangelist, apostolic leader in the independent charismatic movement. And the charismatics were, I just mentioned in the latest Real History, there's a connection between the charismatics and the Pentecostalists. So those are these gifts that you're baptized with the Holy Spirit and you get spiritual gifts. And so this is Paula White Cain. And she's a charismatic and she's the head of a charismatic, but she's blending this with prosperity theology. Now, don't get me started on prosperity theology, you know, that God wants to prosper you. Okay, well, anyway, that's it. There's charismatics that obviously, you know, if you've been baptized by the Holy Spirit, and I am being sarcastic here, then God would want to just, you know, cover you in material wealth. Anyway, I mention this because I look at what's going on in politics from time to time. I hate following it, but I look at it and I see nothing but theater. So someone who we've been told he's a gang member from MS-13 is deported, and he's wrongly deported to El Salvador, and then people are protesting on the streets, and I wonder where do they get these protesters? They all come with signs that look like they were made for them by the protest sign manufacturing company of America. And some of them are wearing masks on the street. I mean, I hope that they're wearing them for the dust storm and not the big C, but who knows what people get up to in their heads. And there's just this, you know, screaming from left to right, as the left is, you know, that we're just outraged that he's deporting people and, you know, he shouldn't be deporting them. And the right is saying, you know, yes, he should be. And so it's theater. And of course, the Christians surrounding Trump and the White House are on record as saying in no uncertain terms that these deportations are, you know, the God's work, the Lord's work. And everyone around Trump, and I don't think that there's any mistake about this, you know, his young, good-looking Catholic press secretary, there's just a huge coterie of so-called Christians. I, you know, don't know any of them personally, but they call themselves Christians, even including the one that I mentioned last week, Scott Bessent, who's part of the this tariffs everywhere, here a tariff, there a tariff, that will do nothing but hurt the little guy who somehow swallows that this is for good for us, that it's really somehow going to bring back manufacturing from China, that really somehow Trump and all of the people around him are for the little people, you know. So a couple of days ago, I guess it was Thursday, I was over at Betty's in the afternoon, where I have been pretty much every day for a couple of months now, helping her. And we were doing some small inside organizational project. See, I read the New York Times and it told me to clean and organize, so I did it. And she received a call from a retired pastor who just wanted to make a visit on her. And so that's what he did. Now, this pastor, he's older than me by about 18 years, but there's a connection going back to my childhood that his father knew my father and all of my uncles and knew, you know, Aunt Betty, and he was a local pastor here, and then he rose the ranks to be higher up in church organization. And so he's deceased for quite a while now, but this is his son who followed in his father's footsteps, as I think possibly all of the three boys did somehow get involved in church work of one form or another, and the daughter too. And now he's retired and, like I said, older than me, so he called me Missy, which, you know, that's what I was known as when I was a child. So he hadn't seen me since I was a child. But he was happy to see Missy and talk to Betty. And he told, you know, stories he was just trying to... He told me a story about when he had seen my younger brother in a circumstance about 20 years ago in California. And, you know, so it was like that. And he showed pictures of his children and his grandchildren. And it was very sweet. You know, it was sweet of him, right, to pay a visit to my aunt. And she updated him on her grandchildren, her grandson, and her great-grandchildren, and all of that. So at one point, as he was showing the photographs and everything, he got out a photograph of two men. And I, of course, immediately, as soon as I looked at it, knew who I was looking at. And he said to both of us, "Do you know who this is?" And I said, "Yeah, it's President Jimmy Carter with your dad." And he said, "That's right," because Carter was in profile. He was in profile facing this pastor's father. And So they got to talking about how President Carter was a good Christian man. He was a good Christian president. And there was a comment there that this pastor made that, not all of our presidents have been good Christians, but Jimmy Carter was a good Christian. And then Betty asked him if he had seen Carter's funeral. And he had. And she said, "Oh, I watched it all start to finish. I watched everything around it." And they were talking about the different speeches and tributes that had been made during the funeral proceedings that had lasted a day. And she said, "I told Missy to, watch it. She didn't watch it, and I told her it was all up on YouTube, and so I'm being shamed because I haven't kept up with the funeral proceedings of President Jimmy Carter." And but what I was thinking about is how in my whole lifetime, that's all I have seen or been told is that it's so important that your leaders, your political leaders, be, Christians, and the church is really a mouthpiece in one way or the other. And I think that it should just be so obvious that when your church is taking government money, 501c3 in the US, and I'm sure there are many other, you're in your country, your church leaders and your church organizations have their own tax-free heading that they operate under. And when they're getting this from the government, they are then mouthpieces for the government. And there cannot be any other way to see it. And that doesn't mean that there is not some good that comes out of the organization, or that, like I said, wasn't that nice that he came by and cheered my aunt up with a visit. But like I said, in this talk, Alan's pretty blunt about it all. Alan told me about, putting yourself out publicly and saying truth based on your own life experiences, research, etc. And he said, nobody ever, he said, you never want people to, like follow you and say, "Oh, you're so great and you're so wonderful," because he said, this is the mob. The mass man who follows you is the same one that's going to cry for your crucifixion. They're the same people that will turn on you when you do something that they don't like. And I have experienced that for myself, being turned on and how hurtful it is, that, well, they liked me and they liked what I was saying, but now they don't. That's the mass man. It can be one person who turns on you, but it's the mob mentality. And last year, when I posted Happy Easter from the Matrix to the True Trinity, I got a series of comments on one of the channels, and this person said about Alan, all he does is expose other shills like himself who promote the New Age while he denies Christ, and then be that makes him, I guess, I'm trying to make his English understandable, but he denies Christ being Antichrist. The whole theme of Freemasonry is to deny Christ as the only one true God and Savior of mankind. You lived with a heathen, so he's writing to me now. You lived with a heathen who denies Christ, but it's Christ who exposed this new world order, Mystery Babylon, a one world government, one world currency, and the man of sin who will cause all, both small and great, to take the mark of the beast 666. I'm sorry, but your idol, so he's saying, my idol is Alan, is exposing nothing that hasn't been exposed over 2,000 years ago by Christ himself, by the power of his spirit through the hands of his chosen vessels. All New Age deceivers are government plants and funded by the government. His wisdom is foolishness to God. He's no better than Ike, Maxwell, or any of the other false teachers. He brings a false gospel of the New Age, which is from Mystery Babylon, Freemasonic lies, which keep people from believing on Christ for salvation. He teaches the same New Age message as the rest of them, but just a little watered down to fool you into thinking he opposes them. It's called controlled opposition. Alan Watt, Jordan Maxwell, David Icke, David Shaler, they're all shills for Lucifer as they promote New Age witchcraft, which is exactly what the satanic BBC, ITV, and Channel 4 have been doing for years. All Alan Watt does is to make it look exactly like he's in opposition to the likes of Alex Jones, David Icke, Jordan Maxwell, and whoever else is out there. So I'm like, okay, thank you for sharing. Thank you. So like I said, you know, the mob always turns on you if you are not delivering something that they, who are not individuals, have decided is the truth. It reminded me of a movie that I think is very funny, and I watched it with Alan a couple of times, Monty Python's Life of Brian. And Brian was born on the same day as Jesus, and so there was confusion that perhaps he was the Messiah. And people followed him around, and they wanted to make a religion out of everything that he said. And so the crowd, the mob, followed him to where he was staying. And, you know, they're gathered below the window, and he finally goes and opens the window and says, "Good morning." And the crowd screams, "A blessing, a blessing." And Brian said, "No, no, please, please, please listen. I've got one or two things to say." And the crowd says, tell us both of them." Brian says, "Look, you've got it all wrong. You don't need to follow me. You don't need to follow anybody. You're all individuals. You've got to think for yourselves. You're all individuals." And the crowd said in unison, "Yes, we're all individuals." And Brian said, "You're all different." And the crowd said in unison, "Yes, we're all different." And one lone man said, "I'm not." And the crowd shushes him. Shh. And Brian said, "You've all got to work it out for yourselves." And the crowd screams, "Yes, we've got to work it out for ourselves." And Brian said, "Exactly." And the crowd yells, "Tell us more." And Brian goes, "No, that's the point. Don't let anyone tell you what to do." And then one of the Monty Python crew pulls him by the ear back into the room. And that's the last we see of Brian in that scene. But this is what happens if you're not an individual. This is where you end up. You can follow anyone. You can be told to follow anyone. And then the message, which might have been good, say, 2,000 years ago, how many times has that been watered down and repackaged and put in service of a government? So I leave you with that to be an individual and think for yourselves. And if there's some lamb and Easter egg hunting in your future today, I hope that you have a good time and enjoy that. Take care.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Alan Watt standing in for Jackie, who's suffering from some battle fatigue right now. And I'll hope to put us through an hour of various types of information. This today is the 2nd of August 2005, and as most of you probably know by now, I live up here in Canada, further north from Toronto, and our temperatures hit 110 degrees today, and they stayed in the 90s right until about 8 p.m. While this was happening, of course, they were spraying the skies with their beautiful new trails, which they've been laying for some years now. And perhaps those who watch more consistently will notice the different types which they've been creating in the last year or so, which are different from the first chemtrails that we used to see. They're becoming rather artistic with it. And today, along with all the usual little fluff balls and with the curly tails they were creating, there was actually a three-legged swastika, like a nebula. And of course, the three-legged swastika is the symbol for the Isle of Man, where a lot of the wealthy rich of Britain do their banking. So I thought that's quite the coincidence to watch this being made above your head. Another thing too that people are noticing, people who wear glasses or sunglasses are having to clean them much more often than they used to, because there's an oily film keeps developing on the glass, and this is from the polymer, which that gives you that hazy look in the sky when they're spraying. It's from the polymer coming down to ground level. So they're really laying it on now with advanced science, and as we're all well aware, there's no one in the regular media going to go anywhere near this subject. They won't touch it with a barge pole. So they've all got their standing orders that they're out the door, and probably so is their pension too. If anyone tries to inform the media being what it is, mind you, handpicked in the first place. Individually, well, it's no hard job to get them to comply, because they're a bunch of prostitutes as far as I'm concerned. They've been selling the people down the river for many, many years, and they're all for, of course, this whole New World Order. And amongst the journalistic class, you'll find they believe themselves they're part of the elite, because they are really the fourth estate. They're an essential part of government. And always have been. They give the public the view the public is supposed to believe in on all topics. They give us our versions, our topics of conversation. They dish it out to us every day, right down to trivialities which don't affect anybody, but they will not touch any of the main subjects, like the Bilderberger meetings or the main CFR meetings, which is coupled with the Royal Institute of International Affairs, which was set up back in the late 1800s in Britain to bring in a world government based on the English style of democracy, which is under royalty. And we must never forget that at the top of Britain, being a model for the world for this particular system, you still have the monarchy and the aristocracy and all of the relatives of the monarchy. Basically, we call it the establishment in Britain. They run the show, and they tell Parliament what to do. And any politician who's really clawing to get up there, and that's basically a criterion to be a politician, you want to climb up there, they do what they're told by the establishment, and put the bills through that they're told to put through. So really, we live in a world which is almost like the movie The Matrix, where although The Matrix took place in a sort of internet system, an internet reality, this is the reality here. We're living through it, and we can't unplug our heads from the actual internet once we feel tired. We've got to play this game every day. And those who are aware of what's been going on and been following what's going on, I'm sure everyone's feeling a form of fatigue, simply by understanding the horror show which we're living in today. And those who have done the research themselves and the studying, I'm sure, can't help but come to that conclusion that we are living in a nightmare, because those behind all of this wrote about their whole plan centuries ago. And in the 18th century and then into the 19th century, quite a few of their mouthpieces put up books detailing their agenda, and even timetables. Lenin talked about it coming in at the end of the millennium and into the new. That's when the big changes would take place in the West. And he said that in about 1915. So this is an old plan we're living through. Charles Galton Darwin, who spoke on behalf of the elite in his book, The Next Million Years, he talked about the necessity in a post-industrial Western society of depopulating all of the useless eaters, you might say, to borrow a phrase from Bertrand Russell. They believe that everyone exists for their economic system. That's what our function is. And of course, today we are living not only in a post-industrial era, the industry's been moved off to China. We're post-technological as well, and even all the computer industry is basically farmed out to the Far East as well. So we really only have one function left, and apart from consuming all the goods that are brought in from the Far East, we are supposed to be the world's policemen and force the rest of the world, the Muslim countries, into the same system that we live under. So we are economic units in a very sophisticated system which did not evolve by itself. It was planned this way. Every part was planned in minute detail. The public's response to every part of the plan has been worked out like a battle plan in advance. And psychologists and sociologists helped put all this together to give us our news and how we should cope with our news and what we should think about our news. It's all done for us, whereas we ourselves have to just sit back and be downloaded and then just parrot what we're told. That's how simple this Skinnerian system really is. It's not difficult when you realize that thousands of think tanks are employed full-time to plan your thoughts for the future and what you're going to experience in the future, and right down to how you will react to those experiences in the future. So we are in the matrix, as I say, and we can't get unplugged so easily. So one of the problems we have at the moment, of course, is the barrage of even shortwave news, which goes on incessantly about the minute details, and we get a blow-by-blow account of what they are doing to us, the big they, you see, and what countries are doing the saber-rattling towards America, such as China and so on. And then that's all nonsense, because the boys who own the West also own lock, stock and barrel China, and no one in China acts on his own. They take orders from the same elite, the global elite, who set them up in business and financed them. Apart from us, of course, because we did finance the moving of industry under the GATT Treaty. We paid for factories to pull up from Canada, the States, and Europe to China, and we paid for the transportation of all tooling and machinery, and we also signed treaties that we would pay all losses that those firms would incur during the first 5 years of operation. Canada gave them two or three CANDU new nuclear reactors, and they gave them the reactors. At the time, John Chrétien was the Prime Minister, and he came back from China with his big jumbo jet full of businessmen, not ordinary businessmen, obviously, but corporate leaders, which the taxpayers funded once again. And he said, oh, we'll have jobs, jobs, jobs. But what he didn't say was, the jobs are all in China. And he said, well, we've got a good deal with selling these nuclear reactors to China. And they mentioned that the figures in the billions. But then about 4 months later in the Toronto Sun, halfway through the paper, in between sports and sex and everything else, there was one paragraph that said an update on the CANDU reactors to China. And that was that China would not have to begin payment back to Canada for 25 years. And if they still felt they couldn't make the payments, it would be postponed for another 25 years. Now, Canada doesn't have billions to throw around, and what they didn't say was Mr. Chrétien borrowed from the World Bank the money to loan to China. So the taxpayers of Canada were the guarantors for that loan. So we pay off the whole loan. And that's how these scams all work, you see. They don't even bother, as the communists supposedly did, they didn't even bother to steal your money quietly. They had to lie about it too. And of course we have great liars in the West as politicians. No matter how much respect they've been trying to gain for themselves through propaganda and the media building them up to be holier than thou and astute, upright men, it's amazing how our forefathers understood that politicians were basically liars. That's what they do. They're very good liars, and many of them are lawyers as well, and I'm sure it's no coincidence that liar and lawyer sound very much alike, you know. So yeah, these guys have sold us all out for their own personal ends and gain, and they also get superior medical treatment. I think 4 or 5 years ago, maybe 6 years ago, an odd thing happened in the Western countries where the politicians murmured about a deal being made that they and their relatives would be treated for life at very top military establishments. So that was another perk they got added to it all. And of course, I wondered why in this great democracy where we're all supposedly treated equally, that the general population has to wait in sort of factory queues to get in to see a doctor, because that's what we have in Canada, basically. You might have to schedule an appointment 2 months in advance. And by that time, you're either dead or cured, one of the two. So we live in a fantasy land where our thoughts are dished out to us by experts. Our topics of conversation are doled out to us. And they understand human nature. They've always understood human nature. Man has been the most perfectly studied creature on this planet, and the creatures who do the studying, of course, have been here for thousands of years too. And since knowledge is power, knowledge is never lost. It's put into places called archives. For the public, you get public libraries, and of course that's all authorized public libraries, so every book in there is authorized for your consumption, but you will never see or get access to the real archives where the real information is kept. When I was at school in Scotland, I can remember getting this vague history of Scotland and how it tried to stop the Normans from coming in, and it was successful to a great extent, except the nobles began to intermarry with them, and they took over the lordships through marriage. Scotland fought the Romans before that, could not defeat. The Normans couldn't come in either with an army because they were being defeated as well, so they simply used money, bribery, and intermarriage to take over Scotland. But trying to get the history of Scotland from our schools was a difficult task, and what I found out later was that since Scotland was a colony of England, you see, then technically they didn't want any bad news being given to the Scots, like what happened in Scotland in the 1800s when they cleared the Highlands, the 1700s and 1800s, and they put off millions of people into rickety old boats to go to the New World or Australia or wherever they were sending them, and they were being forced off at the point of the gun. Many of the boats sank just off the coast, and the relatives on the shoreline could watch their relatives dying and drowning. So all of this history was wiped out of the history books by a decree from London, so that the Scots would never be upset about London and the way it's run its country. This is the type of whitewashing we have throughout history, and it goes along with the plans and the format set out by John Dewey, who said himself that all conflicts, past conflicts between nations, when it comes to the defeated nations, they will basically be wiped off the record, so no one will know. But I was very lucky in that I had an adult reference library, and the reference books went back to 1500s. And they had documentation from even the newspapers in the 1600s and 1700s. And so I found out I was being taught nothing but lies at school as far as history went. And there I am at night going to the libraries and studying up on what really happened. And what really happened was a horror show. People visit Scotland today and they look around the Highlands and say it's so beautiful, this empty, barren countryside and hills and mountains and so on. And what they fail to realize, if the Highlanders hadn't been kicked off their land, it wouldn't be so bare and barren as it is today. And that was the technique used by London, which really was an ancient Middle Eastern technique, had been used in ages past, where they, in the times of the Nero and Caesars and so on, they moved people around the world at will. Anyone who caused them trouble, they simply moved them off their land and put them into another country. That was standard operating procedure, and this was going on right up to the present time. We find the U.S. went into Somalia. The next thing we know, there are documentaries on the CBC television in Canada, and they're showing you these high-rises built to house the Somalians who left Somalia. And the Canadian government, or taxpayer, flew them all in and supported them. So this idea of kicking people off their land is not new. In present-day Iraq, the U.S. is still attacking various towns. They have a rotation schedule where they go in and bomb it and strafe it and cause terror, and a lot of people are moving away. That's the point of it all. They want them to move. So when we look at this technique of getting people to move who are obstinate and no one likes leaving the country they've been born into, we have to look at the UN agenda, and they want everyone to move from the rural areas in every country and move into these habitat areas, as they call them, human habitat areas, these artificial compounds, you might call them too, where they say in their own website, I haven't checked it, but I've had good documentation sent to me on the subject, and they say there'll be no private property. There will be no ownership of vehicles either, automobiles, public transportation only. And of course your life from birth to death will be watched and observed and regulated by experts, you see, NGO experts. And they have experts for everything. And that goes right back to the format of Bertrand Russell, Lord Bertrand Russell, who experimented with school children back in the early 1900s, long before Skinner. And he brought in the free love thing too. That was another mandate which they knew they'd have to use. So Bertrand Russell pushed this free love, no marriage, just go from one partner to the next. And he was encouraging the children in these special controlled schools that he'd set up to do this very thing. And then they studied the psychological effects on the children who went through all of this, and they followed their lives right through their entire lives. They tried to implement the same program in the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties, by making booze cans naughty but nice, you see. Taboo but nice, the very thing that teenagers flocked to. They brought in the miniskirt at that time. They brought in booze and sex, just do it, and all the sort of dance songs to go with it. But because of all the pregnancies that occurred from it, they had to start building like crazy boys' towns and girls' towns all over the place to accommodate the offspring. They didn't have all the abortion clinics to take care of the fallout, you see. They didn't have the medical facilities to take care of all the venereal disease, which also skyrocketed in the 1920s. And so they went back to their desk again and drew up their plans, and then they worked hard to get the pill. That was a prime priority, and they thought, well, better than just booze, we'll bring out drugs, hallucinogenic drugs like LSD, which is, if you just speak LSD, you got lucid, you see, and lucid is clear, and it's another name for Lucifer, which is just a little joke that they throw in there. But they brought out the drugs in the 60s with the rock and roll. They called it a revolution in music, a revolution in sex, and they had the abortion clinics ready, the private ones that you could pay for, and they also had the street medical facilities where you could walk in and get shots for any venereal disease that you might have picked up. So these guys don't give up. They never alter their agenda, by the way. They simply take it back to the drawing board and try to iron out any problems that they have. So when we realize how old this agenda is, and that it happened long before, it was on the go long before you were born, long before FDR, you can go back into the days of Sumer. The rabbis themselves talk about the agenda beginning around 4,500 BC, an agenda which was to take over the entire planet under one government, one rule, with an elite to rule it, and every facet of humanity to be run by experts. They don't like this untidy method of people being individualistic and deciding what they want to work at or what they want to do for themselves. And going off and maybe building a place here or there, it's just too untidy for them, you see. We're dealing with control freaks, and these control freaks just don't let up. They can't let up, that's their nature. They want it to be under their control, and they'll decide where we live, how we live, and what we say, and everything else, and what we do. This again was all experimented with within the Soviet Union, where they did have school to work. You were tested at the age of 5 and 6 for any special qualities or any areas of study, and then they said, okay, you're going to be an engineer and you're going to be a laborer and you're going to be a plumber, and you were only taught what you had to be taught to make you a plumber or an engineer. You didn't get any extra curriculum or any extra history or geography or science. It was irrelevant to the controllers. All you had to know was how to do your job when you left school. And that is the same idea that's coming here. It's too untidy, you see, to have people being taught all these different things and then deciding what they want to do. Why not save the bucks, train them in one area only, and you have a dumb, stupid population who don't know very much except how they fix taps, perhaps, or make a technical drawing on something. But that society is a very easily managed society because they're kept in ignorance of all the other generalities and studies. So from a control freak point of view, that would be perfection, you see. And we know where it's going from there. We know that Arthur Koestler, or Koestler, depending how you pronounce it, which is K-O-E-S-T-L-E-R, he worked for Stalin as an officer, and he helped starve the people in the Ukraine. He talks about it in a book which he wrote called The Ghost in the Machine. And The Ghost in the Machine, by the way, is the elusive part that psychiatrists can't pin down. It's you see. It's the essence which is you. The real you. It's elusive to these characters. And so Arthur Koestler came from this communist country as a communist officer, and he went over and taught in universities in the United States and New York, and he was attached to the United Nations, and he worked in think tanks, global think tanks, where different groups of scientists had their speciality, all working from their own area of expertise on the same subject. And the subject was, how do we remove that part of the brain in individuals that gives them their personal identity? It lets them know that you are you, distinct from other people. And his expertise was in the psychological approach coupled with drugs. And he also worked with surgeons who were doing various kinds of lobotomies and so on, when they were pretending that that was a cure for depression. They had lots of people to experiment on, and many people came back to the U.S. from abroad in the military in World War II, and they were having prefrontal lobotomies. Actual post-orbital is behind the eye, and this was supposed to be a treatment for the battle fatigue and the shock they'd gone through. Meanwhile, of course, they all got studied for the rest of their lives to see how it affected their personality. So Kessler had all this information, and he was trying to find new ways for the near future, and how to do the same thing. How do we destroy that part of the person that makes them an individual? Because individuals, you see, are very problematic. They take whims and fancies. They go through fads. They're just not controllable, you see. People who are sovereign individuals want to do their own thing, and the elite just can't have that. It's just too messy and too untidy for their system. So Kessler worked with other surgeons, with chemists and so on, and they found ways that they could target a specific area of the brain and knock it out, basically. You might call it a chemical castration of the brain. They didn't want to destroy your higher abilities of mathematics and passing on information and so on. What they wanted to do was to stop your individual and analyzing abilities on those particular topics. In other words, you could repeat stuff, but you couldn't think of it yourself. There's a break coming up, so I'll be back shortly. I think it takes about 2 minutes, and I'll see you on the other side. And you can send donations to Jackie to keep it on the air. We have enough stress, as I say, by understanding and keeping our finger on the pulse of what's going on, that we don't need the added stress of the finances, which is always there. So do what you can. My name is Alan Watt, which is W-A-T-T, and I have 3 books for sale. I go through a lot of the history of the last few thousand years in this agenda. I go through Freemasonry, and I don't begin with the usual nonsense that it all started with the guilds, the tradesmen guilds in the Middle Ages. No, that was only a small part of it. It's been here for thousands of years, and secret societies are well documented in ancient Rome. So my name is Alan Watt, which is W-A-T-T, if you want one or all of the books. And you can call me if you have something to talk about. I don't like preachers, because I don't need to be saved, you see. I always say that Jesus saves, but I'm not sure what bank he uses. And since people today have no idea what it really means, although they've been told by the World Council of Churches that they think they know what it means, they're just whistling in the dark. And so are most of their followers. Religion is one of the prime means of mind control. Yes, it gives comfort, because it's designed to do so. But it doesn't give you answers to anything, and it also tells you to obey government. That obviously was tacked in there by the priests who took over in Rome. it's so odd that they're following a man who was killed for his viewpoints and for speaking out freely against the corruption of his age. And he spoke out against the priesthoods who ran the religion. He spoke out against the bankers who were in cahoots with the priests, as they always are. They killed him for it, you see. And so in the New Testament, somewhere in Paul, somebody added, obey government because it's put there by God. Well, if you believe that, then don't decry Adolf Hitler because he was elected into government. Don't decry Bonaparte, Napoleon, when he took over. Don't decry Lenin. In other words, every tyrant that was put in under your own philosophy was put there by God. So that's your problem, and you'll have to deal with that yourselves. Especially when you're following someone who definitely spoke out against it. But that's your double think of today. Now, getting back to Arthur Koestler, working in the think tanks for the United Nations, he did say that they were successful by different means, by chemicals, and I've no doubt they used sodium fluoride, which is in the tap water in the cities. It's in the toothpaste. It was used in the Soviet Union, and it was also used by Nazi Germany, and because they knew the effects of it. It slowed down the brain. It slowed your intellect. But Koestler also talked about more efficient biochemical means where they could actually attach organisms if they want to like viruses or bacterium, to specific hormones which go straight to your brain and attack that vital area. Once again, this part of the brain that they want to knock out is you. It's who you are. It's what gives you your ability to perceive yourself as a distinct, independent individual, distinct from others. But that's a nuisance, you see, to the controlling elite. They have to use massive media and propaganda to keep each individual happy today. They've got all these services out there, and they have to put sports on for people to keep them occupied, or movies with sex or violence and all this kind of stuff. But the fact is, if they could possibly destroy that part of the brain, they wouldn't need all of this anymore. And maybe that's the right way to go, because we wouldn't need the media anymore either. I wonder if they've thought of that. What happens to them when they're no longer required? What happens to all the sports commentators too, and all the networks when they're no longer required? Because under that last meeting that was held, World Meeting of Scientists, sponsored and paid for by the U.S. Department of Commerce, and headed off or kicked off by Newt Gingrich, which didn't appear in the newspapers, these characters, these scientists, have a chip ready to implant in the brain. And lo and behold, the main scientist from Japan said, it will be the end of individuality as we know it. It will be more like the beehive, in fact, he said, because everyone will be interlinked with a regional computer which will direct them as one would direct a robot. So they won't need media to keep people happy, because people will be quite dumb and happy as their program tells them to be. They won't need the sports, and so they won't even need politicians eventually. I wonder if they've thought what they're going to do, or what their function would be in such a future, because politicians, outside of their job, are the most useless creatures you'll ever meet. The men don't know anything about fixing anything or how anything works. All they do is sit and scheme, and their job is to get other people to work for them. That's what politicians do. They're psychopathic personalities. They have no function in any other system than this one. So, as I say, Arthur Koestler wrote about it in The Ghost in the Machine, and that book is definitely worth a read. And in the last chapter, he goes through the whole agenda, and he thinks it's just wonderful, you see, that they'll have peace on the planet. There'll be this strange utopia for the elite, who will not, by the way, take a chip or have their mind altered in any way, because they have to guide the planet. And as he said, And as Charles Galton Darwin said, and as the scientists at the Loyola University meeting said, he said that only the elite will need their faculties because they will be guiding the ship. In other words, their ability for self-survival, self-preservation will be functioning, whereas the masses will not, because the masses will have all their problems taken care of for them by the state. So this Borg mentality that they showed us in the Star Trek movies, the original bee, that's what Borg stands for, by the way, we are the worker bee, and they lived in square spaceships because they were the Ashlar, the Masonic Ashlar. They were squared, they were not natural, they were part cyborg, and everyone was connected to a central computer, just like they talked about at the meeting at Loyola University. And they have the technology to do this. At that meeting, they said the only problem they have at the moment is convincing the public to accept it. That's the only problem. They have everything ready to go. It's been tried and tested over many years on unsuspecting people, and they want to go ahead with the beginning in 2009. And hopefully, they said, they'd have it completed by 2018 or 2019. And also, one of the main speakers, politics, by the way, wasn't mentioned once at this meeting. This meeting, which churned out 600 pages of their agenda and was totally ignored by the media, although many of the media guys were present. They said that they will promote this from kindergarten. They'll promote it as a positive thing in school. They'll promote it through all novels, all magazines, all fiction writings, and then movies. Now, these guys didn't say we would like it to be promoted. No, they said it's going to be promoted. And that's how things really work, you see, in this matrix that we live in. They didn't mention politics because they are well aware that politics is a sideshow for the public. Many years ago, they found out that the public would rebel and overthrow total corruption. So they came up with this thing called democracy, where if you think you can change the system every 4 years, you go ahead and vote. And then after the next 4 years, well, we'll vote for someone else. And that stops them having all these problems as they fill their pockets with our money at the top, and as they make us work for less money, or devalue the money, or rob us from our taxes, etc., and hand it out to their corporate buddies and foreign insurers. If you wonder why Africa is poor, read the agendas. Read the economist, the great economist John Stuart Mills, who wrote about it in the 1800s, that the black man was to be basically eradicated because he would not fit in to the Western economic system. He said some will survive, and his own words were, because they can mimic the white man. But those who couldn't mimic the white man were to be eradicated, and we see AIDS decimating Africa. Absolutely. And we know, too, it was definitely the smallpox, the free smallpox shots that the UN went around and gave them all, and tried to blame on the failure to change needles from one person to the next, which was a nice cover story because the AIDS virus is well documented, including the funding to create this thing which would destroy a person's autoimmune system, and so a common cold would turn into chronic bronchitis or pneumonia and kill you. That's how it works. This is the horror show that we do live in, and those people who are on the air and who are genuine, and not all of them are, understand this and have to live with this knowledge every day. They're not off chasing UFOs like Art Bell, or worried if NASA can make it with the next space drama as a tile comes off and all this nonsense. No, this is to suck you in and support NASA, which does nothing really except put up satellites up there which work in conjunction with HARP, and they spy on you. That's NASA's main job. That's what it does, you know. So yeah, those on the shortwave who know what's happening have to live with the knowledge every day. They have to cope with the reality and the bleakness, because we're going through a bleak period right now. Everyone is who's aware is sensing something coming quickly. Something wicked this week comes, as they used to say. We know there's more and more restrictions, especially in rural areas, with what you can and cannot do, and they're passing laws all the time. We know the gasoline's being pushed up, and Mr. Rumsfeld, at least on the media up in Canada, announced that gasoline might double. He said going from $70 a barrel to $140 a barrel, and that was a trial balloon. They do this once in a while to test out the public reaction as they do their quiet polls all over the place. And as long as the media doesn't follow it up, and they don't, and the public are trained only to think about what the media tells them to think about. So if the media seems concerned about something, then so are the public. Zygmunt Brzezinski documented all of this in Between Two Ages, one of his books, in the technotronic era. Now, the technotronic era is the era we live in, and it's an era where they use advanced secret technology, advanced and secret from the public, but really old technology, such as the HARP program, coupled with satellites and so on, to once again do their favorite little act, which is to try and control the minds of the public. HARP is beaming out now 24 hours every single day. They step up the power when they really go to town and spray the skies non-stop, and this has a tremendous effect on our weather. They can either cause thunderstorms, or they can spray over thunderstorms and dissipate them. That's why there's a drought in many areas. So they can do both. This is old technology, going back to Tesla, at least Tesla, although I doubt it, to be honest with you, because if you read about the Etruscans, who were the ones who built all of the subterranean tunnels under Rome, prior to Rome, and the Etruscans were also the people who had tremendous engineering. They taught the Romans how to build. That's where they got all their ideas and engineering skills for the aqueducts everywhere they went. Because wherever you go, the first thing you must do is steal the water, you see, and that's what the Romans did. So the Etruscans used to be called in to Rome on high festival days, which were just like today. They're all linked to the sunrise, sunset, or stars appearing, certain stars, or the moon, and which are still used in all high occult masonry today. And the Etruscans' favorite trick was to call down fire from heaven. So those of you who think that something new was put into Revelations where the great beast would call down fire from heaven should think again, because the Etruscans were doing this 2000 BC right up into the time of Jesus. So it's not a new trick, but it was never explained how they did it, but they certainly could do it. They could literally conjure up fire and bring it down from heaven to earth on demand, and I would call that a definitely advanced science. Science is the most secretive thing, because it gives you power, it gives the holder power, and you never share knowledge, which is power. So it's no surprise to me that many technologies are being used today which are completely unknown of by the public who read popular mechanics or popular science, and they tell you, oh, we're just working on this, and one day we hope to be able to do yada yada yada, when in reality that's all part of the matrix. Whatever they tell you they're working on, the higher level of science, and there are three levels of science, you see, there's three levels of medicine too, from professorship down is the lowest level. So that's the real matrix, the low level, you see, from professorship down. So whatever they give you as being the latest is really antique. And what they really have is so far advanced that it's beyond what we're even given as science fiction. That the CIA had little handheld gadgets back in the 1950s, which were like mini harps, and they could literally pulse into your brain voices, commands, and so on. And it worked. These little machines worked on line of sight. And Professor or Dr. Nick Bagage displayed a whole bunch of these antique little mind control gizmos from the CIA on Wendy Mesley's show here in Canada about 4 years ago. And he had about three benches full of them. And this technology, of course, could also be, and here's the kicker, just like the Star Trek stun gun or the phaser gun, you could also set it to match the automatic beat of the heart. In other words, you could stop the heart if you wanted to. And we wonder why people had sudden fatal heart attacks years ago and just odd coincidences. And of course, we could never have done that because we didn't have the technology, did we? And that's why they get away with it. They never tell you what they're really using at the time. Now, Nick Bagage just also took this stuff over to the European Union Parliament because some of the members there were having these strange, weird attacks just before they got up to speak in Parliament. And he displayed it and demonstrated this stuff. And he said, there are people here who are using it on you. So this is old technology, antique technology. Well, if it was the size of a TV remote converter or a packet of cigarettes back in the 1950s, you can imagine how small it is today. And if you ever get strange thoughts or strange queasiness or feel terribly nauseated and you happen to be speaking out about things, well, maybe it's not so paranoid after all to wonder if maybe someone's targeting you, because you certainly could be. Now, the whole problem comes back down to, what do we do about all of this? There are no groups you can join. Groups are immediately infiltrated or else are set up in advance by the controllers. And all you can get back to is number one. When you understand that you're simply living in a long, long succession of this plan, your lifetime's a little blip in one part of it, then you stop panicking. Your government is not being taken over as you live. It never was your government in the first place. It wasn't your father's or your grandfather's either. It was a system that was cleverly designed up long ago to give the impressions that people were really enemies and countries were really enemies and had us all fighting each other while the elite benefited from it. They kept the population down. They made tremendous fortunes through war. And they just happen to always own all the manufacturing processes. But that, of course, must be a coincidence, too. So stop panicking. You're not being taken over as you live. This has been going on for thousands of years. And you can take comfort in the fact, too, that there's been a long, long lineage of people with the knowledge of what is happening who don't belong to this elite controlling group, who go on down through the ages with the knowledge and helping to pass it on to other people. That's why we know so much today. So, just like you start off with an avalanche, of course, is this new upcoming world order of total control if they get their way. You also have had many small snowballs being rolled along the ground and getting larger and larger and larger as time goes on, as we go on through this tremendous journey here, through time and space. And you must always keep in mind that eventually a critical mass is met. And the critical mass does not depend on vast armies of people. It depends on the right quality of people with the right self-knowledge of who they are in the great scheme of things, and who are totally honest about themselves, because which is always the beginning of enlightenment. And you also come in contact with others of your own kind. The knowledge itself doesn't stay with you. Each time you speak it anywhere, as they know themselves, we basically broadcast. People actually broadcast, you know. when they have a eureka moment, something suddenly strikes them, and they'll find that people across the planet are being hit with the same thing at the same time. And this is something which is at the moment outside of their control, but they do recognize it, they know about it. Arnold Toynbee, who was the Rhodes Scholar and a globalist for the elite, he ran the scholarship programs, I should say, Professor Arnold Toynbee, made a speech about it, and he said, you know, when a thought is put out there, he said, it's well understood that people pick it up all over the planet. So when your heart is pure, and you're as pure as you can possibly be, you don't want to stop things as they are and have some vague pretense past come back again, like let's live in the Victorian age or something. No, you're honest about the whole system, and you know the whole system is unnatural. Then you can broadcast, as I say. Others pick it up, and it's like putting a series of batteries together. The voltage increases tremendously with each person who wakes up and starts to really come alive and think. Well, that's been a pretty brief hour, and I've rambled on a bit here trying to get a lot in, and nothing is prepared, but I hope for you it's been of interest. I guess Jackie will be back tomorrow night to talk to you about other things. Thank you, and good night.